Where were you on January 6th? Let's talk about 1 year ago, the ripple effect of pro-Trump supporters storming the U.S. Capitol. It is PolitiFact's Lie of the Year and its significance to our country's state of democracy on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's one moment of that afternoon, Republican Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin sheltering in place in his office and talking on the phone with CNN.
I have not seen anything like this since I deployed to Iraq in 2007 and 2008. I mean, this is America, and this is what's happening right now. The president needs to call it off. Like, call it off. Call it off. It's over. The election's over.
What are you thinking as you saw those images? Why do you think so many falsehoods, so many conspiracy theories have grown up around these events? 800-642-1234. Angie Drobnik-Holen is editor-in-chief of PolitiFact. She and our colleagues have been writing about the events of January 6th. Angie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. I'm glad to be here.
What is coming up for you on this day?
Wow. Well, when I think about a year ago, we fact checkers were already thinking we were going to fact check some traditional political speeches as Congress was going to count and certify the electoral votes for the presidential election. And then all of a sudden, those proceedings were disrupted as protesters physically broke into the Capitol and the day became quite different. And then we were kind of glued to our TV screens along with the rest of the American public watching these events play out. It was shocking and unexpected.
Before we go deeper into January 6th, just take a moment to step back with some observations about what elected officials say and why they matter. And I imagine you spend a lot of time looking at PolitiFact truthometers, making sure your gauges are reading correctly. But I also imagine finding truth and giving something a rating can have its challenges. What was last year like for your meters as you and your team traced falsehoods and conspiracy theories and misleading statements?
It was a tough year. I mean, the purpose of our fact checking is to give people the information they need to govern themselves in a democracy. And in previous years, it's been a endeavor that we do with some civility, but I think everybody knows civility is on the decline. And watching the Capitol physically assaulted is at odds with deliberative democracy, where we're supposed to get together, debate issues, have consensus, and then the losers are supposed to concede. I mean, that's a very important point of having a peaceful democratic society, is that people do not take up weapons when they lose. They have to accept the results of elections. So that was challenging. And then I just have to add all the fact checking we've done on COVID and misinformation on COVID is also absolutely a factor in a tough year, because it's something we consider naming our lie of the year, because people do need accurate information to make health decisions. And there's been a lot of misinformation about COVID.
I was listening to a clip of you last year in February, I think it was, and saying that as Biden is in the White House, new administration here, PolitiFact won't care much about rating and fleshing out what former President Trump says. That was the sentiment, at least for what you were saying there. Did that bear out? Could PolitiFact look away from former President Trump?
We are still watching former President Trump, but we are trying to do it judiciously. I mean, I think Donald Trump's supporters and detractors would agree that he is very good at getting media attention. From a fact-checking perspective, he says a lot of things that aren't true. So we really have to balance correcting the record with not giving undue attention. I mean, I think that's one of the challenges of journalism these days is what merits coverage and what doesn't. We are in an age of information overload. So sometimes the decision not to cover something is just as important as the decision as what to cover. I mean, Trump's place in American politics to me is very ambiguous right now. He seems to have a lot of influence in Republican primaries, but his influence is not without limits. For example, today he intended to give a press conference at the end of the day about his thoughts on January 6th, and it was canceled after other Republicans complained and said it would not be helpful to them politically. So I think that's a story we're watching in 2022 and certainly the 2022 midterms. What is Trump's role within his party and within U.S. politics?
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Angie Drobnik-Holin, editor-in-chief of PolitiFact, and she and our colleagues writing a report detailing the many lies being spread about the deadly January 6th insurrection. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Lisa now in Madison. Hi, Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I have to say on 1-6, I'll never forget the day. I was shocking to see what was happening, but at the same time, not surprising. For a couple of years, I've been following and listening to Christian Piccolini, who is a former leader in the white supremacist movement. And he has expressed over those years on NPR, I've heard interviews, I believe he's testified before Congress, that there would be violence if Donald Trump lost. And, you know, he talked often about the lies that were being spread, as have a number of other people that I've been listening to. So not surprising what happened, sadly.
Lisa, thank you for taking time to call in. Angie, you know, Lisa, they're saying not surprised, not surprised. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it does have this kind of paradoxical nature of like surprising, not surprising. I mean, for me, seeing people like scaling the walls of the Capitol was surprising, but this was not not without warning signs. When we looked at the people who came to the US Capitol that day, we found a mix of motivations and outlooks. Some of the people seemed like just everyday Americans who truly believed that the election was stolen and had been convinced that the right response to this was physical action. Now, I should add, very importantly, we looked at many, many, many specific claims that there was election fraud or ballot boxes being moved around. And all of those claims, they came up with nothing. I mean, they were photos taken out of context. There was video that didn't show what the people said it showed. We did have a very valid election in 2020 overall. There may, like a few votes here and there may have not followed procedure, but not anywhere near enough to overcome the results that made Joe Biden the winner. Then the other group of people that we saw were these people in organized groups, white supremacists and militia groups. And they had a very different sort of motivation. They seemed to think if they could disrupt the proceedings that Donald Trump would take care of the rest.
That something would change.
That something would change. I mean, I think that's what our caller was referring to, that I think some of these people had these ideas that if they could just pause the electoral count process, that other actors in the government would overturn the results, which is essentially a political coup.
I want to listen to a clip here. About a month after the insurrection, Republican Senator Ron Johnson here of Wisconsin was the guest on the Jay Weber radio show, and here's what he said.
This didn't seem like an armed insurrection to me. I mean, armed, when you think here of armed, don't you think of firearms?
Mm-hmm.
Here's questions I would have liked to ask. How many firearms were confiscated? How many shots were fired? I'm only aware of one.
We're going to stop the tape there. You know, your reporter, Eric Litke, ruled Johnson's statements as pants on fire, numerous weapons confiscated, found that day. What are your thoughts on those kinds of statements from a sitting senator?
It's a prime example of this effort to downplay the events of January 6th. And we documented so much of that this year. There certainly were weapons around the Capitol. Guns and explosives were confiscated that day. And then there were also not guns. I think the focus on guns is somewhat misplaced, because people came to the Capitol with like trenchants and implements of to smash windows, to break into the Capitol. It was not a peaceful protest by any means. Now, okay, I mean, I think we can all be glad that there wasn't more gunfire and that people weren't, that there weren't, I mean, you can imagine a situation with much more casualties. We should, but like this idea that, oh, well, it wasn't that bad. I mean, that is not borne out by the testimony of the Capitol Police. It's not borne out by what congressional staffers saw and experienced. So this is a false statement.
PolitiFact Editor-in-Chief Angie Drobnyak-Kolin with us on the legacy of the deadly January 6th insurrection and what that day means to our pillars of American democracy. Your thoughts on how the Capitol insurrection has further divided our country politically? How do you think January 6th will be remembered in years and decades to come? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a reporter giving an eyewitness account of what was unfolding, narrating what is happening at just after noon, our time, 1 year ago, courtesy of NPR.
Oh, meanwhile, up on the steps of the backside of the Capitol, we're seeing protesters overcome the police. The police are now running back into the Capitol building. We have cheers from the protesters that are watching behind the scenes. Incredible.
What do you think about what you saw in those scenes? What did you believe? Who did you listen to? 800-642-1234. PolitiFact Editor-in-Chief Angie Drobnyak-Kolin stays with us. Angie, let's talk about the media. Fox News and its treatment of the insurrection. How did that add to the lies and the misinformation?
What we saw when we looked at the events of January 6th and the way people reacted to it was a lot of downplay and denial. And the Fox News primetime hosts really led this effort, especially Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham. What we see is this dynamic in place where it's one questionable claim after the next. And when one is fully exhausted, they move on to the next one. So first Fox News said, oh, well, this attack is terrible. It's probably Antifa. That would be the left-leaning activist. Well, it was not Antifa. There's been not a shred of evidence to show it was Antifa. Everyone who was held up as an example of Antifa has been shown to be a Trump supporter. Mm. Then they said, oh, it's not that big of a deal. It's a peaceful protest. Well, there's a lot of video evidence that contradicts that. And then they moved on to conspiracy theories. This was especially Tucker Carlson's claim that the FBI instigated January 6th, or that the prosecutions have been violations of constitutional rights. None of that is true. But it was just, and it was just one thing after another. The media would start it. Sometimes elected officials would repeat it. It would end up on websites and TV and this kind of noise machine. And I should just note, these theories are radically at odds with each other. It can't be Antifa and a peaceful protest and the FBI. That does not make much sense, but that's the kind of messaging we're seeing.
Let's talk for a moment about language, because John from Menominee called in, couldn't stay with us. John is concerned about the language that journalists are using to talk about January 6th. John says a lot of reporters say that Trump lies, but reporters don't call Trump specifically a liar. So John also says we also didn't call January 6th a coup. Can you talk a bit about the language we use to describe this day?
That is one of the biggest challenges I think journalists are facing, because we have a lot of different concerns from readers that pull us in different directions. I think that journalists need to be observers and telling people what really happens. And I think part of that includes a little bit of professional detachment. Now, at the same time, we don't want to shy away from calling out falsehoods. One of our chief ethical obligations. In fact, I would say our top ethical obligation is to the truth. But we hear from readers who say, like, you're not calling out the liars harshly enough. Then we also hear from readers who say you're biased and you're against Trump and you never give him a fair break. So we are trying to navigate this middle ground where we place truth first, but we also just call it like we see it without having to heap on any extra condemnation.
Angie Drobnik-Holland with us, editor-in-chief of PolitiFact. I want to talk a little bit about yesterday's speech. Attorney General Merrick Garland said yesterday, in just running the numbers, issuing over 5,000 subpoenas and search warrants, seizing about 2,000 devices, looking at over 20,000 hours of footage, searching 15 terabytes of data estimated. You know, those numbers seem to insinuate the act and work of seeking truth and justice. But does that have any effect on the spread of lies?
Such a good question, Kate. I mean, I think certainly prosecutions of any kind have a deterrent effect. So when people are prosecuted, you hope they're not going to be like, oh, it's a good idea for me to go to the Capitol and try to break in again. The court system is a truth-seeking process. And one of the things that gives me hope is that we've seen courts over and over demand when people come into court making false claims about stolen elections, the judges have been very good about saying, you have no evidence, I'm tossing this case. Mm-hmm. I think that is one of the strengths of the US legal system right now, is that it seems to be holding firm. But I also have to say the penalties against politicians and media figures for saying things that are lies seems to have declined in the time I've been fact-checking. There are more political lies. There's a lot more of shrugging it off of, like, I mean, Donald Trump is a classic example of this. When he's called on saying things that aren't true, he kind of shrugs it off or changes the subject. He doesn't have any shame or remorse about it that I can see. So I think that's a good question. And it's like, where are we as a society where the penalties for lying seem to have diminished? Like, how do we get that back? I'm not sure what the answer is.
Let's go to Jeremy in Rice Lake. Jeremy, hi, what's on your mind?
I just had a question of why they're talking about this so heavily and all the riots that had gone, you know, taken place, and Congress people kind of inciting that too. And that's just kind of gone to the wayside now. It's all about the insurrection on January 6th.
And Jeremy, when you say Congress people inciting, what are you speaking to specifically?
Like over in Minneapolis, Omar, and there was one other woman that was talking about, you know, that they need to take over this.
So are you talking about, like, are you trying to make references to Black Lives Matter protesters here? Or I'm really trying to understand, get more clarity.
Well, that and why they're not pursuing what these Congress people had said, you know, getting these people riled up about all this. I mean, it's not any different to me, I don't believe.
Angie, your thoughts here.
Yeah, this is something that we hear from our readers too, of you're concentrating so much on January 6th and you're letting the Democrats who are far to the left off the hook. This is where it's like, it's all, I don't want to be a spokesman for all of you as media, but at PolitiFact, we are fact-checking both sides. We do fact-check the Congress, the member of Congress that he mentioned, and others. But I don't think the two sides are exactly the same right now. And, you know, we talked earlier about what we choose to cover and what we choose not to cover. We're not trying to make both sides look equal here. Mm. We're not trying to make the Democrats and Republicans look exactly the same. Now, no political party has a monopoly on truth, and we do fact check the Democrats. But it's kind of hard to give these people who want to see both sides called out equally. Like, that's not the reality of the situation we're in right now. Both sides are not equal.
Angie, thank you for joining us. Appreciate you being here. Angie Drobnik-Holland is editor-in-chief of PolitiFact. We have a link to PolitiFact's reporting on its 2021 Lie of the Year. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, the Omicron surge and what it's doing to small hospitals in Dodgeville and Medford. Are you caring for COVID patients? What are you seeing at your hospital? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Hospitals in Wisconsin now face a record number of patients in ICUs battling COVID. We check in with a pair of rural hospitals on how they're handling the surge on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Health Services tweeting yesterday after the second day in a row of a record high new confirmed cases, quote, please protect yourself and your community, end quote. Healthcare teams, what is your hospital experiencing? Are you newly diagnosed with COVID? Are you vaccinated? 800-642-1234. Lisa Schnedler is CEO and president of Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville. It's a nonprofit independent healthcare system with 25 beds, including 3 ICU beds. Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be with you.
Good morning. We also have Dr. Philip Beauvais, an emergency department provider at Aspirus Medford Hospital, also having 25 beds. Dr. Beauvais, welcome to you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're in the emergency room normally at Aspirus. What is it like right now with COVID patients? What are you seeing?
Right now, there's a lot going on. We have a lot of sick people who are coming in. And interesting characteristic now that's different from this wave compared to the one last year is we have more boarders. So people who we tried to get them admitted into the hospital, but we don't have beds. So the ER is becoming more and more of a place for keeping longer term patients. So I'm about to start a shift now after this. And two of the patients who I saw on my last shift are still here after, 30 plus hours. So that's a different feel that we're not used to.
Wow. So what you're saying is they are basically staying in the ER because there is no place to transfer them to if they need a hospital stay.
Correct.
Well, that's concerning because when you are in the ER for that long, certainly others coming into the ER, you're going to have a backlog before you know it.
Yes, it's typical to start a shift and have several boarders. When I did my last shift overnight, we had 5 boarders, which is the most that I've seen. A couple weeks before that, we have an 8-bed ER here, and our board was full with 25 patients. So trying to manage all that it can be overwhelming at times.
Are these mostly or all COVID patients? Are they coming in with other things? What do you see in terms of why they are coming in?
The majority feels like it's COVID or COVID-like symptoms, or they have questions about it, or mm-hmm. flu-like symptoms. We have seen a couple cases of influenza A, so that's coming up in the community too. But otherwise, we're still seeing people with heart attacks and strokes and accidental injuries and bone fractures and various other things too. So, that hasn't gone away at all with our normal community needs. So having COVID on top of that with the Omicron wave is just, it's all the more.
Compounding. Lisa, over to you at Upland Hills Health. What are you experiencing?
Well, the situation that Dr. Beauvais described was where we were 2 weeks ago. We were just filled. The beds were filled upstairs. We were holding 9 in the ER. We were spending hours on the phone trying to transfer patients and couldn't get anyone transferred. Hospitals were closing the ability to transfer. So it was pretty dire at that point. Right now, the biggest impact we have is on Omicron coming through and causing sickness among staff family members. And so we're having a lot of vacancies in staff, not as many patients in terms of the inpatient unit, but certainly we are. Our testing is just astronomically high. We have never seen testing this high. To give you an example, usually when we test our staff in the morning, we have results in the afternoon, but our testing center has the capacity of only doing 1,000 tests a day. They were able to keep up. Yesterday, they were getting 2,000 tests in, so we have a 48-hour delay on that now. So it's testing and it's staff vacancies here right now.
So with the staffing vacancies, if your staff have symptoms, they're staying home, of course, and for days. What impact does that have then as you try to have enough, you know, care teams to do the work on the floor?
Well, I've been here for 8 years, and the highest number of traveling staff members, those coming in from the outside that we pay to come in, we've had two at a time, maybe, oftentimes none. We have seven on site now, and we could use more. So we're able to offer the care. Thankfully, we haven't had staff with specific skills to have, you know, zero in that skill set. We've always had at least one or two able to be here. But yes, it is really stressing staff at this point because they're pulling long shifts, and we're just trying to ride this wave.
Dr. Beauvais, how about staffing for you? What is it like?
Yeah, similar situation. We have traveler nurses who come in. We need ultrasound techs. We have only three full-time ER docs now, so I'm our director and our scheduler, so I'm scrambling to try to find there's more locums or other people who can come in and work. And then if one of us gets sick, which has happened throughout the past 2 years, then we still have to scramble even more and try to make up for it and then help each other out later on. So it's a difficult situation.
Dr. Beauvais, are you concerned about what you're seeing with breakthrough infections and what you're seeing with Omicron here?
It seems concerning more so because of the volume. The severity doesn't seem as much. People aren't as sick or don't need to be hospitalized as long. However, with Omicron being 2 to 3 times more contagious, just the sheer volume of numbers is going to be concerning, especially over the next 1 to 2 weeks. That's, I think, how we're going to know when this wave peaks out and just what the numbers are going to be. So until then, it's just trying to brace ourselves as best we can.
So when they enter your ER, of course, they're asked about whether they've had their COVID vaccine series, whether they've had a booster. What is your sense as to the people coming into your hospital? Are they fully vaccinated or not?
In the hospital, you know, up to 90% of the people who get admitted COVID positive are unvaccinated. So you know, the best way to protect yourself is to get vaccinated and even better, get the booster. When people come into the ER, it's a difficult situation because what we're most concerned about is, you know, are you vaccinated? So we want to ask that at some point. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of complaints. People think that that's too personal of a question sometimes, or they don't want to talk about it. So I've treated it more like an insurance question because we're not supposed to ask insurance in the ER. We just treat people. And we have to ask insurance at the end. So I'll treat COVID patients, I'll treat all of them regardless of their vaccination status. But toward the end, then after they know what the care is and there isn't that influence of, am I asking just to see if they're vaccinated? I'll bring up the topic of vaccination and plant the seed. Okay, you feel terrible. Now, if you want to have this feeling go away, you still have this after 3 months, the vaccine can still be helpful for symptoms, or tell your friends what this is like, get vaccinated, and try to promote it that way.
Take that moment. Yes, Dr. Philip Beauvais, emergency department provider at Aspirus Medford Hospital. Lisa Schnedler here, CEO and president of Upland Hills Health. That's in Dodgeville. And we're discussing COVID care in rural areas. Lisa Schnedler, Dr. Beauvais describing there about the trickiness of asking about whether someone has been fully vaccinated, whether someone has had a booster, whether they've had their first shot. How are you grappling with that with patients in your hospital?
You know, the vast majority of patients in our hospital have been vaccinated and have had boosters. Those that come in with COVID and deteriorate or have strong complications are tend to be unvaccinated. And as this virus continues, emotions run high. People are very tired of wearing masks. You know, they're very irritable. Many of them aren't working now. And there's just a lot of stress on families. And so we try to be very respectful of what is happening in our patients' lives, but still try to show them that we are their advocates. You know, we're here to help them get healthy, to maximize their ability to live their lives. We're not here to argue with them. And I think our staff has just done a tremendous job in really putting that forward to say, listen, we are here for you. We are here for you. And we want your best health. And our belief is the best health is to get vaccinated and to get boosted. But if you have made a choice different than that, we're here for you still.
Lisa, I would imagine you're also dealing with staff burnout who have to walk this line each day and talk with patients about why they need these vaccinations. What is burnout like for you?
You know, I think our staff has tremendous resiliency, but yes, they reach their limits. And they are very supportive of each other, and they are very supportive of the patients. And so when I go up to the floor and talk to them, and are they tired? Absolutely, they are tired. They are very, very tired. But here, you know, in this hospital, they're taking care of their friends. They're taking care of their family members. They're taking care of parents who go to school with their children, the children of those patients. And so there's just a lot of heart here to say, I'm just not going to let these people down. And so it's amazing. And when people say that these healthcare workers are heroes, my admiration, I've been a hospital president for 31 years. I have never had the level of admiration for a team that I have right now, because they come here every day, no matter how tired they are, and they are here wholeheartedly for these patients.
They're taking care of their own community. They're
exactly.
Seeing their neighbors. Dr. Beauvais, what is it like for you with burnout, you and your colleagues? How are you dealing with that?
I second what Lisa said, too. I think we have a great team here, and, yeah, we take care of each other, the community members that know, and some of us. So it's a great community to be a part of and to help each other. And the way we cope is, you know, sometimes it's okay to cry. Otherwise, it's really helpful. We did a Secret Santa this past December, and it was a lot of fun giving each other gifts to try to help brighten the mood and to get through this. So that building that sense of community, that it is bad now, but it'll pass eventually, so we just got to get through it together.
Emergency medicine physician Philip Beauvais there, health system CEO Lisa Schnedler is in Dodgeville, and Dr. Beauvais based at Aspirus Medford Hospitals. We check in on the latest surge in COVID cases, how it's affecting rural hospitals. Clinicians, what is life like for you in these times? How are you handling the stress? Nearly 2 years in, still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with healthcare providers in Dodgeville and Medford, Iowa County, where Dodgeville is experiencing critically high case level activity. Taylor County, where Medford is, very high activity, according to DHS's latest data. We'll still time to talk about COVID in your community. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Schnedler, CEO of Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville. Dr. Philip Beauvais is in the ER at Aspirus Medford Hospital, about to start a shift, and they're with us for about 10 more minutes. Lisa, here's a question for you that just came in. Tina emailed and asked about how rural hospitals afford travel nurses. How much are those costs, and how long does it take for them to get used to working at a different hospital?
You know, there are complications with that, because we have to take time to do a complete orientation. They have to get used to our equipment. They have to get used to our version of Epic. So they can't just come in and start to work right away. The cost is probably 3 to 4 times what we would pay a staff member. But we do that to take care of our patients and to relieve the stress for our staff. And so they understand why we're paying those very, very high rates. You know, our board has been wonderful through the years of setting aside money for something just like this. And so they understand that we have to spend those reserves right now to get through this. And that's why we're here and we're a nonprofit. And those monies were put aside years and years ago. To be able to endure something just like this, not anticipating this, trust me, but something like it. And so we're grateful that we have the reserves to be able to draw upon to give that relief to our staff.
Dr. Beauvais, are you having to rely on these travel nurses in the ER, or is it mostly the people who have been with you in the ER all along from your team?
Well, we have travel nurses too, and it's been regular for 2 years now, I think.
Okay.
So, and they have their limits too. We've had them extend their contracts because, yes, just like Lisa said, you have the orientation and the overhead costs for it. So it's important that if you get one who enjoys it here and you got a good one, try to have them stay as long as they can to help out.
Yes. Lisa, you opened drive-through COVID testing recently, last week, I think it was. How is that going?
Well, we started that 2 years ago, maybe just shy of 2 years ago, and it's going well. We have staff from all over. Even our director of IT goes out and does swabbing. They're trained. We train them through a rigorous training system, but we have enough staff in reserve to keep that effort going. Now we're having to really watch the supply of test kits. That's the pressure point right now. At one point it was staffing. Now it's test kits. And so we followed the judgment of our medical team here in terms of how we test and who we test, and really kind of ride that wave of test kit shortages until we can get to the other side.
How are you rationing test kits?
Well, to just give you an example, it used to be that if one individual in a family got COVID, the family often would come in a car and we would just test everyone. We are now directing them to kind of a screening. And if we have, you know, a healthy 11-year-old, chances are we aren't going to screen that individual. But if we have a person who's a grandmother in that family, we are going to screen that person. So there's an algorithm we take them through now. We don't just screen the entire family. We're trying to just hold on to those test kits until we can get a good supply of them. We have a sufficient supply right now, but we don't have the abundant supply we had 4 weeks ago.
Dr. Beauvais, how are testing supplies holding up for you in Medford?
I don't have exact numbers, but I think we're doing okay. Everybody who comes in gets a test. We do PCRs more so. We have rapid antigen available also. People can come in and just be tested also. So we appreciate that they don't have to have a full ER visit. So we have those options available too.
Let's go take another comment here. Steven Sun Prairie called, couldn't stay with us. Steve says that they check DHS website each day. More people are going to the hospitals, but the hospitals are getting more money, but the number of emergency room beds are not increasing, and is wondering where those resources are going and why aren't ER beds increasing. Can you feel that, Dr. Beauvais?
Yes, I think in rural hospitals, you know, some people think, oh, we can just have more beds, but we have a space issue. So we only have 8 ER rooms in our department, but we have a specialty clinic next to us. So we can spill over to that and have another 7 rooms that aren't optimally set up for ER. But, you know, we've had to do that at times, and we've had all 8 ER rooms full, all the 7 specialty clinics full, and we've had patients in the hallway or ambulances come in, and we've had to just put up a sheet at times. So we are having discussions about, you know, how can we accommodate more space with the surge and try to be better prepared for the future, because most likely this is going to happen again someday. So,
Lisa, what are you doing about spillover, and what are those discussions like about expanding the number of beds?
You know, we're very fortunate. Right before the pandemic hit, we built a new med-surg floor, an actual building with med-surg and ICU and pre-op and post-op. And so we had our old med-surg unit available to us. We also had our old pre-op and post-op unit. And so when COVID hit, we were able to staff two different units on two different floors, one for COVID patients and one for patients that weren't testing positive. So space has not been an issue here. Staffing has been an issue for those two floors. We thankfully are not at that point now. We have 12 patients in-house today. Two of them have COVID. So right now, Omicron isn't presenting the bed issue. It's presenting the staffing issue.
We're talking with Lisa Schnedler, who is CEO of Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville. And Dr. Philip Beauvais is here, emergency department provider at Aspirus Medford Hospital, as we look at the care of COVID patients in rural parts of the state and what the impact of Omicron is having on hospitals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Beauvais, Taylor County, where you are, is located in a population of about 20,000 people, and state health authorities say about 35% of the population has received the first COVID vaccine dose. That is the lowest vaccination rate in the state. How does that make you feel as a healthcare provider?
It's disheartening when you have the best thing is prevention, you know, compared to treatment. But it correlates with how Republican it is also. So I think Trump won it by over 70% here in Taylor County. So it's unfortunate that it's very politicized and people still come in and they say COVID, no, they have pneumonia or they have something else that's causing it. So part of it is trying to convince people still that COVID is real, that the vaccination works. And it's important to try to take care of themselves, and we're here just to help them. So we're not trying to get their vote. We're just trying to help save their lives. You know, then they can go vote however they want. We just want to help people as best we can.
Lisa, back to you. And the Supreme Court tomorrow will have hearings on two challenges to the Biden administration's vaccine requirements that affect nearly 100 million workers, including healthcare facilities like yours. How is Upland Hills handling the federal mandate amid these challenges to it?
So we are holding tight and waiting for the ruling from the Supreme Court, and we will follow their lead on this. So we have elected to not enforce a mandate with our staff on vaccine, but we are very fortunate. We have an 87% vaccinated staff. And so we feel like we're in a really good position with that. And, you know, when we look a little bit deeper into the numbers of the hospitals around us, even those that have a mandate with the exemptions, I would say we're right in line with what their numbers are. And so we don't think the mandate will take us any further down that path. The best way we have found to convince people to get the vaccine is to ask them to go to the trusted physician that they see for all their care and to have a very thoughtful conversation with that person. Forcing the vaccine has certainly not been productive that we have seen, but those conversations where people feel that they can disclose why they're not getting the vaccine, what their concerns are, and get a very thoughtful, honest answer have produced the most success.
Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. And I just ask everybody, you know, stay safe during this time. Do not go into big gatherings, particularly unmasked, and just ride this out with us for 4 to 6 weeks. And we think we might have a really good outcome at the end of this if we can just all hang in here together.
And Dr. Beauvais, thank you so much for your work and thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.